Okay, well, welcome everybody to Concurrent 8B, Fearless Leadership, where neuroscience meets leadership. My name's Melinda Howes. I'll be your chair today. So first of all, I'd like to introduce our speaker today, who's come down specially to Melbourne to talk to us, and being a non-member of the Institute, we're very happy that Catherine's taken the time out to do this. It's great to have an expert of her calibre able to present to us. So I'll just introduce Catherine and then I'll hand over to you. Catherine McLennan began her career as a strategy consultant with Booz & Co. in Sydney and an MBA with top class honours from Stanford and a BS, Bachelor of Science, I presume that is, not the other meaning.
Well, both. You'll soon see.
From Duke University, where she focused on, I've got to take a deep breath before I say this, psychoneuroendocrinology.
Well done.
Which Catherine tells me is psychology, neuroscience and hormones. So, yeah. Transforming strategy into execution became her next passion, where she led the 4 years of operational planning and execution for the 40 competition venues for the Sydney Olympic Games between 1996 and 2000. Since then, Catherine's added to her qualifications, becoming a qualified psychotherapist, and she's run several leadership development practices in Australia, including PricewaterhouseCoopers, Metal and Heidrick & Struggles. In December last year, she left the Commonwealth Bank, where she was Executive General Manager of Talent and HR, to re-enter leadership advisory with advisory firm Johnson, focusing on C-suite leadership assessment, development and succession planning for ASX top 50 clients. Please welcome Catherine.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, psychoneuroendocrinology is definitely a mouthful, so you did very well, especially the biological basis of behaviour. And you know, I think you have a chance to look back every now and then in your life and you kind of go, why did I do that? Why did I study, you know, rats injecting all kinds of chemicals into their brains to actually look at what they did in the field? And every now and then, coherence arises, and you kind of go, okay, well, I'm kind of using it now, and I work in the field of leadership, and started in strategy, went into execution with the Olympics. You're never going to get more execution than you do in the Olympics, but really fell in love, particularly in the last year of the Sydney Olympics, with the notion of leadership development, because I watched a lot of my venue managers rise and fall according to the strength of their leadership, and so I got really fundamentally back interested in behavior and what happens with leaders in their minds, because strategy is one thing, execution is another, but leadership is fundamentally what really was successful in that particular event. So since 2000, I've been studying leadership in corporate executives, and I've been incorporating, and what you're going to hear today, a little bit about my undergraduate, which sort of surprises me. So I'm going to pull in some neuroscience today and talk to you about fearless leadership using some neuroscience models. You might find it a little bit interesting, maybe things that you haven't heard. It doesn't mean that it applies just to CEOs and CFOs and everybody else. It actually applies to everybody, every human in the workplace, or at home, for that matter. I find it quite interesting. And I actually find it quite interesting that a lot of it's based on wisdom that we've had and forgotten and continue to forget every day since man was man and women was women. So let me start with the fact that I often use leadership as synonymous with choice, and Robert Frost does it very well. In fact, two words, conscious choice. So conscious choice is the ability to make choice, and you'll see that concept throughout the presentation I make. The ability to consciously choose what your mindset is right this very moment. You might even do a scan of what your mindset is right now, where your brain is. I guarantee I do not have 100% of your attention. Where is the rest of your attention? Do you have an ability to enact an observer within that can watch where that attention is? That's kind of the key to fearless leadership. Fear exists everywhere, and having been in CBA for the last 2 years, Commonwealth Bank, I got to watch our executives deal with the crisis up in Queensland and watched fear on the ground and how we responded to that. And that was real fear that is survival-oriented. Christchurch. One of my best friends lives in Christchurch and was able to kind of at least experience it through her and I visited it last year, and to see real fear, fear that should be experienced, fear of life and death, Japan's crisis, and the radiation that followed. Now, interestingly enough, I have been giving this presentation, and I love giving it, so don't worry, I won't fall asleep, but I've been giving it since 2007, and this slide has not changed. And, 2008. Nothing has changed. If we think the crisis is still happening, it is. And we're still dealing with the amount of stress that we're still dealing with, and these headlines haven't changed. These headlines were in 2008. This is causing fear in us that may not be completely rational or useful for really clear thinking. And you see it all day long. I got to see it for 2 years when I was inside CBA. This is the type of photos that you see in the workplace all the time. It's me. And this is the type of emotion that you see in the workplace all the time, and fear and anger and emotions. And a lot of it's based on a brain mechanism that's useful to know how it works. I always say fear, when it's not for those life and death situations, when it's in that work office kind of state, is false evidence appearing real. And we feel it all day long. I watch myself these days go through the emotions. I can actually see, almost visualize my brain going through the emotions when the classic, which I'm going to take you through, classic symptoms start to occur. What I'd like to do today is take you through a four-part model that helps us understand why it is that it occurs and what we can do about it. And the first part is knowing what triggers us in the workplace, or at home for that matter. The second part is knowing how we respond automatically. And that's pretty straightforward. You've all heard of the automatic response mechanism. It's fight, flight, or freeze in some cases. And for many of us facing the financial crisis that we continue to face, we don't fight, we just go to compliance. And I saw that left, right, and center. I see it in my clients. I saw it in the institution I was there. We won't do anything more or less than our so-called KPIs, and that's it. And innovation absolutely dies. There's nothing that's happening. We're just going to the letter of the law. But the interesting thing is, how do you actually get out of that automatic mechanism? And that's where that word choice, conscious choice, comes in. The neuroscience, some of this behind it, says that for any stimulus coming into your mind, whether it be a serious life and death stimulus or a pretend life and death stimulus, it takes about 0.3 of a second to register it from your subconscious to your conscious mind. Once you've got it in your conscious mind, it takes about 0.2 of a second to make a decision on whether you're going to react to it or take a conscious choice to do something else. And they call that veto power, and that's really the essence of leadership for me. In that little 0.2 of a second, that's where conscious leadership occurs. And the fourth part that I'm going to talk about is, it's really hard to go from here to here without the fitness of mind. And this is an exploration, an area that we are only just beginning to rekindle. Funny enough, I actually am you might find it interesting, some of you, and some of you might find it odd, that I am in a Buddhist group of people, of very well-known chairmen and CEOs and a couple of other hangers-on like me, that study under a teacher called Sogyal Rinpoche, who's the author of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. One of the reasons that they all gather together to study is to rekindle that wisdom of the mind and how to discipline the mind. Because the mind has gone nuts in this day and age. And the kinds of things that we do these days with our 24/7, constant travel, constant online type of living is just making it worse. And so we need to be able to start to understand how to get our mind fit so that we can go to choice three and not choice two. So let me explore each of these parts. And I'll actually pause every now and then and get you to reflect with your neighbor, because I don't want to talk at you the whole time. And it's good for the mind, too. Just a tiny bit of science. I promise. Let's see, does this pointer? Okay. If you wanted to think of the brain in three parts, it's just to really make it simplistic. And by the way, every time we study more about the mind, the less we know. It gets more and more radically unknown to us every year that we do more research. So I find it quite a fascinating thing to study. I don't know how that compares to actuarial studies, but the mind is a phenomenally interesting thing. And those of you who loved their physics, it's the observer-created reality. What you observe is what you create in the mind. And it's you never go to a neuroscience conference. Maybe the actuarial conference is different, but a neuroscience conference is like the Tower of Babylon, because everybody's studying a different part of the brain and nobody actually knows how it all comes together. And it's a magical. It's magical. It's amazing. I really just think we're babies in the evolution of it. But let me just attempt to make it incredibly simple, and which is probably a joke for the universe. Sorry about that. Three parts, if you wanted to think about it. The most, the reptilian part is the spinal column, and just around here at the back of the neck, and that is just the reptilian part. It's really important in the fear and the stress response, because it's what automatically keeps your temperature what it is right now. It's automatically keeping your breathing rate and your heart rate at doing. You don't have to think about it. It's just there to do it. And that's what we need, that reptilian part of our brain. The second part of the brain is kept inside. It's all these colored parts of it. It's known as the limbic system or the mammalian part of the system. And it's where a lot of our repeat mechanisms, the things that you use to do spreadsheets over and over again, the way you drive your car, it's also the seat of our emotions. It's where emotions arise, particularly in related to incidents that we recognize. You know, oh, here we go again, anger. Oh, here we go again, fear. That is where a lot of the source of those emotions and repetitive ways of thinking occur. And the third part of the brain is the most evolved part of the brain, called the cerebral cortex. And that, particularly in the frontal region, just behind your forehead, is the prefrontal cortex. And it's really the most evolved part of our brain. It's certainly the most evolved of all the species on Earth, the prefrontal cortex, and it gives humans our special ability to rationalize, to make decisions, to keep cool under pressure, and to look at multiple models, and to sort of see which ones we want to do, to innovate, to actually think clearly. The interesting thing, though, is that this thing is another term, a fun term that people give to it, is it's the Goldilocks of the brain, because it's just never happy. It's constantly not happy with the environment, because if anything is too hot or too cold, so to speak, it will be overridden by the more emotional part of our brain. And that is clearly so. And it's a very slow part of our brain. So I don't know, has anybody been in a near-term car accident over their life? Yeah? What happened in the near-term car accident?
Someone came.
Oh, sorry.
Someone came and hit on a bridge.
Yeah, and were you able to get out of it?
Eventually.
And what, was it just an automatic reaction to get out? It's fast, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really, really fast. We are very grateful for this part of our brain. If we use this part of our brain, we'd be dead. It's, you know, I was in a near-term car accident. I was driving in Boston, so on the right side of the road with the left-hand drive, so I've got to visualize it, right side of the road. I actually think, and I still can't tell you for sure, but it would have had to be right on the verge of my peripheral vision. A Mack truck was bearing down on me diagonally, had the kids in the back, and I was in danger of either them dying, all of us dying, really. If I had used the prefrontal cortex, there's just no way. I would have had to analyze it, the direction, the velocity. I would have had to then instruct my body to make the turns. I would have had to thought about where I was going to make the turns. There's just no way. In that split, tenth, millionth of a second, this part of the brain took over. and it knew what to do. It just eased me into the side of the road. The Mack truck went through, went into the intersection, hit the next car in the tail. Fortunately, nobody was massively hurt, but that certainly would have been pretty clear near-death situation. What occurred there, which is really important in the leadership scheme of things, is the amygdala. The amygdala are these two little red olive things that basically take all that stimulus in and ask a question. Is this a life and death situation, or is this not? Pretty binary. If it is, it actually bypasses that slower part of our brain, and it goes into survival mode. My colleague, who studies a lot of the neuroscience work and then applies it to leadership, is a person called David Rock. He's prolific. If you want to read him, he's got gazillions of things on the internet. So David came up with an acronym, which I really like, and I give him full credit for it. See if I've got it, which is, I'll show you this, and then I'll go to the acronym. So let me just show you that stimulus here. So in comes the stimulus, goes to the limbic system. The amygdala say life or death. If it's no, everything's just fine. I'm trying to make a decision on my, I don't know what you guys make decisions on, life tables. whether you're going to give that person insurance or not, I don't know. How you're going to respond to those flood victims, and I don't know. It'll go slowly to the cortex, and it'll go slowly into that mechanism where you can have that nice, quiet, rational thought. If the amygdala says it's a life and death situation, however, it blocks that signal, and it goes down to that reptilian part of our brain. And what it does makes sense, right? It says, okay, heart, you need to pump because you need to get the blood to the extremities. The circulation goes to the extremities, away from the organs, because we need glucose in our hands and our legs. Yeah. And so what we want to be able to do is respond. So in that sense, it's a terrific response. And David's acronym was SCARF. So what it stands for, and I'm going to get you guys to have a reflection on what's happening in your workplaces, whilst life and death situations are useful for the amygdala, workplace situations are not. And what's interesting is the research is showing us that typical workplace situations can actually cause a life and death response by the amygdala, which causes the fear response. And here it is, status. Status drives us nuts. It drives us absolutely nuts. And it doesn't matter how peace-loving and Buddhist you are, everybody will have their own version of what status is. And I can't tell you how many times I enjoy walking into a meeting room first so I can watch everybody else walk in next. Because everybody subconsciously determines what status they are expecting to have in that meeting. And then they behave accordingly. And if they don't get the status in that meeting that they were expecting, they will have a fear response almost always. You can always see it. And it comes out in various ways depending on what your personality is. Now imagine, you know, all the status symbols that we live with. I mean, I lived in a corporate that had titles that had, you know, you can't talk to this title because that title has executive in front of it and that title has general in it, so general executive, but then you can talk to it if it doesn't have executive general, it'd be general. And, you know, it goes on and on. And parking places and office locations, and boy, have we turned that upside down for those of you who have gone to activity-based working models, because now what do we do with status? Because we don't even have assigned workplaces. So
it's on where your locker is now.
It's where your locker is, right. So status, when we don't get the status respect that we afford, and you'd be amazed at how this works. It works in me all the time. I can see it in my own behavior. You can have this fear response. Certainty is another one. And certainty is a pretty, you know, if you would go toward a car and expect to flick the key on to open your car door and you're confronted by a pad code that says put the PIN number in, your brain is going to register a mistake. And when your brain registers a big enough mistake to the patterns that it's expecting to see, you will probably have a fear response, an amygdala hijack. That's how Daniel Goleman coined that term in his book, Emotional Intelligence, the amygdala hijack, just hijacking that prefrontal cortex and sending that fear response. So the responsibility of leaders or anybody in this is to provide enough certainty, even though they don't even know whether it's really right to go left around the mountain or right around the mountain, at least pick one and be certain on it. But the interesting thing is the A in the model is autonomy. And we are apparently wired to need enough autonomy and control in our own day and our own destiny that when leaders come and micromanage us and tell us, all right, yeah, we're going left around the mountain, but this is the type of boot we're going to wear, and this is the type of, this is how much weight we're going to carry in the backpack, and this is the model of the the radio you're going to carry. That's not good either. And I think what is core and classic about leadership is that balance between giving your people enough certainty, and you guys would understand that. I know you study certainty, or the lack thereof, but yet enough autonomy. And that constantly shifts depending on where the person is in the development curve that they're on and what context they're in. And that's what makes leadership such an interesting art. The goal of leadership, if you wanted to put it in neuroscience terms, is to get your people into prefrontal cortex mode and to not let them be triggered by some of these classic ones. R is for relatedness. We need to be part of somebody. We need to feel part of a team. As soon as our boss invites our colleague to the particular function and we don't get invited to, classic. Fear response probably will occur unless you're not aware of it. If we're not part of a team and we feel isolated, classic. Being in an organization, having been outside an organization for most of my career, I was just appalled at how many intra-company battles there were between different functions and different business units and different lines. Well, I understand now. A lot of it's about creating that us. And in order to create that us, you've got to create them. And once you have that, then you've got that relatedness that we all crave. And it's fascinating to watch. And the last one is fairness. Oh, by the way, on relatedness, the interesting thing is they do one of my favorite neuroscientists is a guy called Matthew Lieberman, who does terrific work on what he calls social pain sometimes in the workplace. He's out of UCLA, and he and his wife do this work where you get put in a functional MRI and you're told to pass the ball, electronic ball, basically, I guess with your thumbs, and you pass this ball to two other people, you think, that are playing the game with you. So you pass the electronic ball to them, and the three of you play this ball very nicely. And then all of a sudden, those two don't throw the ball to you. And just by excluding you on that silly little electronic ball game, you can see on the functional MRI that hijack occur. So you can see how delicate Goldilocks is and how much we're wired for survival. This brain is wired for survival and will always overreact. And that's the trick. Fairness is also another interesting one. Now, this will be interesting in this audience. Is it Anthony? Okay. I'm going to give you $1,000, right? But the deal is you got to give Andrew some part of that $1,000. And Andrew's got to agree with you, and then you can both take that sum. How much are you going to give? You're going to give half. Okay, you're going to give... Okay, say it again in the mic for us.
I give him half. He used to be my boss, so he's a good boss.
Okay, you're going to give him half. Okay, do you accept, Andrew?
I said pretty generous.
Pretty generous. Anybody else? Come on, where's the real economist in the room? Anybody else have another offer for Andrew? Where's that? Oh, come on. We've got some hardcore economists. Come on, don't you guys learn that? I'm sure you do. Okay, you give him 100. All right, give him 100.
100.
Andrew?
Do I regard as a reasonable offer?
Would you accept?
What do I need to do for it?
You don't have to do anything. You just have to accept the deal.
Sure.
Yeah, easy. What if I gave you $1?
No, I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't. Anybody else would accept $1? Of course, you would, because it was $1 more than anything. If you were thinking in the rational economic term.
Yeah, but it's an insult.
But it's an insult, yeah. And it's not fair. Yeah. Right. So most people wouldn't accept it. Thank you for falling into that category. Most people wouldn't accept it. And having hung out with lots of asset managers and lots of corporate financiers for the last 2 years, I can tell you when bonus time comes out, it doesn't matter whether their bonus is $8 million. If it's less than their colleague's bonus, they will have a massive amygdala hijack. So I'd like to pause there, and I'd like you to turn to your neighbor and just reflect on how this manifests in your own workplaces and whether this model makes sense. And then I might take one or two comments from the field. So just take a pause and just digest this and see if it makes sense in your own workplaces. Have some great examples or any insights, questions at this point? You can jump up. Got a microphone roving around. Any great reflections? I'd like to pause. No?
Well, I picked someone at random.
Yeah, why not? Thank you.
Janice, I'm not going to say what company.
Oh, no!
I have the privilege of being in a state-based office that is the first office to go to activity-based working in a few months.
Yeah.
So we're not quite sure that that's a high-status or a low-status decision to make us the guinea pigs, so that's causing some problems. High level of uncertainty about what that means.
Yeah.
We've been given external companies, including Commonwealth, as that works down there, it'll work for us, but it doesn't help us very much. Autonomy is interesting. The argument is, you know, more autonomy in how you manage your day, but much more standardised sort of approach to all statuses within the firm.
Yeah.
So that's causing interesting. And relatedness, I hadn't really thought about till now, but it's very much some teams have said, but we need something special.
Yeah.
Because we're special.
Yeah, we are.
And other teams have gone, well, you're not that special.
Yeah.
We're special. Yeah. So those sort of discussions have been very interesting to observe, putting my fight or flight to one side.
Yeah.
And the fairness, I think, is if people are coming out from that angle in order to try and calm down. It's been fascinating to think about trying to get people to step back from that panic reaction and just think about it. What is it really going to mean? Is it a good,
well done.
Good way? So
well done.
I'm going to take those back
that's
and
great.
Talk to some people about
Man,
that.
You do it. Well, good thinking on your feet. That is well articulated. Thank you very much. I find this model really useful in myself, actually. Any other, do you want to add another comment?
We were just talking about mobile phones and the status, about which one you've got in the corporate office.
Yeah.
And I was actually thinking because, you know, in the corporate office, a lot of people, it seems what phone you have is quite important and has to be. But I've got three teenage daughters, and believe me, it's a lot more competitive there than any corporate office.
You know. That's right. Thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's so funny. I've got my kids are just bordering on teenage now, so I'm learning all about status redefined. So, yeah, good. Any other? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Marilee Sill from Comintra.
Marilee
We're the activity-based working office that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And my experience with that is it does create an interesting divide between people who tend to start work later in the day versus
yeah.
people who tend to start work earlier in the day.
Yeah.
The early birds get the status.
They certainly
they get
do.
The desk.
Yeah, you got to get them really early. Really early.
That's right. And they get the certainty because if you come in a bit later, you might not get a desk.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And you have to sit in the group area.
Yeah.
So there is an issue there of relatedness in terms of you feel possibly excluded. Those people who come in later feel excluded
yeah.
from the group.
That's great. Yeah, no, it's fascinating. It's fascinating what's causing us the upsets, you know? Yeah.
Just a bit of a reverse experience. I used to work for a firm where cars were very important, status
yes.
symbols. And
yes.
I had a Citroën C3, which was a nice little car. That was terrible because I wasn't acknowledging and recognising the importance of the status.
Right.
Because it wasn't important to me,
right.
everyone else felt threatened.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting lesson for actuaries, because actuaries on a whole are pretty self-confident and
yeah.
status isn't a feature of this profession.
Yeah.
But the people we work with, it is. And if we don't acknowledge and respect that, we can get into trouble inadvertently.
Yes. Toyota Yaris driver. I always used to... I did have a nice position with a nice title and everything. And I used to pull down into the car park and I'd just be, trying to make my way between the Porsches and the Mercedes and I don't know whatever else it is. And here's my little Yaris. But anyway, I found that quite humorous. Anyway, but I have my own status, we all do, and I laugh every time I get triggered by it. So it's an interesting one. The second part is knowing how we respond. And look, I'm not going to go into too much detail here because I just wanted to get you a flavor for it, but if you wanted to put all the world's psychology into an incredibly simple model, you can see how simple I like it. You could say, okay, above the water you can see everybody's behavior. You can see, because you can do audits right now of what consciously you're intending your behavior to be. But we really are run by a lot of mechanisms, circuits that were put in place, even the research is telling us in utero. And it's fascinating, the research and what it's telling about the mechanisms that we're learning and the behavior that's always already getting wired from the time those cells join together. Male, female is one of those very interesting ones. So we actually are driven by some pretty subconscious needs that many of us, I would say the majority of the leaders I've worked with, really aren't quite aware of. And if you really were going to keep it incredibly simple, you'd get that, over the behavior that you're seeing in the people that you're working with. But underneath, you'd get maybe, if I had to simplify it, some of us are driven by a real needs for attention or approval, and I often say that's a heart-related need. Some of us are driven by that real autonomy I was talking about, and you often see them express that anger. It's a very somatic body kind of reaction, and some of us are driven by security, the need for security, and usually that gets reacted in fear. And all I'm going to do with that is say if you multiply three by three, you get kinds of different combinations. And those of you who study different personality instruments, Myers-Briggs, for example, or Enneagram is another interesting one. You can look at that up, Enneagram, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M. The Enneagram concept's been around since Plato, and it tells you human behavior hasn't really changed fundamentally. And this is just all kinds of personalities that arise from the way we behave when we're on autopilot and the underlying need that is explaining that. And, just to give you an example, when I do the thing, and it's all free online, so there's nothing majorly here. It's kind of interesting. This is me. I kind of like my term romantic. But I know, when I'm not making that conscious choice, my automatic stress response is to get out of there. I just do not like being on the scene. I won't stay and fight, but I don't go into freeze either. I just get out. I get out of the scene. And I know the underlying need is approval. If I'm not getting that approval, I'm an approvaholic, basically. I kind of have done so much work, and I can see it when it's happening. And that is the important. And when people say you've got to do more self-awareness, it's because you're catching yourself in the automatic reaction. So just do a quick, think to yourself right now about, what's my automatic reaction at work when I'm on that autopilot? Where do I usually go? Sometimes it's very different at home than it is at work. When I'm not conscious, what is it that's driving me? What am I not getting? What need is not being met? And that's very useful. There's many others. Those of you who have done DISC, same thing. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail. I think the slides are available. But again, it's a lot of these personalities are based on fears of things, that your needs are not being met. Might I say the actuarials are usually down here? Anyway, okay, well, oh, good.
Because of the profile that's been done on the profession.
Oh, what is it?
And it's actually...
Sorry, the profiling was actually done on the profession because there was a study done on it. And actuaries, there's a much stronger extrovert orientation than you would expect.
Fantastic.
It's about 40%.
Great.
And in fact, actuaries are far more extroverted and sort of conceptual
people-oriented
than, say, the accounting profession.
Oh, that's great. So, I like to learn things.
Hard.
Thank you. Bless you. Now I can use that in my next presentation. No, so you can tell how ignorant I am. Thank you. Choosing rationally instead is the name of the game. And question.
Sorry, it wasn't a question. I just wanted to add to Andrew's survey results. Those surveys were relative to the accounting profession, were they?
No.
You just got to give it to those accountants. All right. The thing is, we do have a choice. If you haven't gotten that by now from what I'm talking about, then wake up. We have a choice. We have a pause button, and that's the essence of all leadership self-awareness courses. And that's all I have to teach, really, is that pause button. But that is so hard to do because that veto power is so short, and it's 0.2 of a second, because normally we'll go on autopilot. But my hero in this case is Viktor Frankl. Anybody heard of him? He's a terrific, inspiring, probably one of the most inspiring writers, because he suffered what I would say is the most fundamentally horror, terrible stimulus that you could possibly imagine in the human race. He's a German psychiatrist, studied under Freud, but he was Jewish. And so he suffered from, he went into the concentration camps, lost his family, lost his friends, lost all of his work and his research, basically almost lost his body, came about that close, and discovered the last known freedom to human being, which is the freedom to choose one's mindset given any situation. And he experimented in that for the rest of the concentration camp. And that's how he kept alive. And he chose anger some days. He chose joy other days. Didn't have anything to do with the situation. Just the choice. Totally separating stimulus and response. And that is our freedom that we hardly enable because we just don't have the strength of mind. So the leader's choice is to see the saber-toothed tiger, have the amygdala to hijack. Most of us in business, in Western business, suppress. And we look like this. Come on, it's election year. And I see it all the time. But the problem with that is your heart rate's still going up. Your blood pressure's still going to the extremities. And you know what's interesting is the science actually says your people subconsciously pick those symbols, those signals up, and their heart rate and their blood pressure and their stress response goes up, even though you may look like you have it all together. I don't know if that looks like it. Pause, false evidence appearing real, that, and okay, my politics. Maybe it doesn't look that great right now, but... So it's a choice. And the last thing I wanted to leave you with is a notion of fitness of mind, because you can't make this choice easily. It just doesn't come easily. I've practiced and I've practiced and I've practiced, and I tell you, I lose it at least 2 or 3 times a day, if not more, that I'm conscious or aware of. And I know I have these. And I can't, you know, staying in the prefrontal cortex is a discipline of mind that takes many hours of cultivation. The brain waves are interesting. And let's see if I can quickly go there. And then I'm going to kind of open for questions. When the brain is in a typical analytical state, like in the workplace, doing typical analysis, typical emails, typical, you know, doing your business. It's in a beta brainwave state. If that beta brainwave state, it starts experiencing, and this is electroencephalograph that just measures the vibrations of your mind. It's just brainwaves. So if that stress response, the amygdala hijack goes in, beta brainwave goes, the frequency goes really high, and that emits the hormones called the adrenaline and the cortisol that we're just completely filled with. We were built to only have it, you know, a little bit, an hour, maybe a week when we fought the saber-toothed tiger. We're not built for 18 hours a day. And that's where a lot of the diseases that we see were on the rise, all absolutely heart disease, no doubt about it, and the rates of depression, which are going sky high, are going completely out of kilter because of the levels of adrenaline and cortisol we're shooting ourselves with on these very high brainwaves. As we go down and we slow that brainwave down, like you guys are right now, the alpha brainwave kicks in and your more imagination and your daydreaming kicks in. And that's really useful because it produces serotonin. And for the one out of three of you, and that's what the current status is, that use antidepressants, that's what antidepressants are based on, releasing more serotonin in the mind. And that's what keeps us more sane. Theta brainwave, and that's my 5-minute bell, so I'm going to...
No, that's the final.
Oh, final, okay. Yeah. So just more innovation. The message is more fitness means more innovation, means an ability to make that pause. And it's a fascinating science. And if I've left you with anything, it's just to say, explore what you're doing for your own mental fitness so that you can exert that leadership, which is conscious choice. And I'll leave that with this one, which is choice. And Winston Churchill, who was the best manic depressive, most famous manic depressive there was, I think said it most beautifully in that conscious choice for leadership. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions afterwards, but I think that's it.
Thank you, Catherine. And I know Catherine will be around for a couple of minutes afterwards, so we sort of did a bit more of an interactive session, so not much time for questions at the end. But I found this very interesting. I wrote an article on this in ACTRI Australia a couple of editions ago on this concept of trying to have that space and time to think. And I think it's something that all of us, if we want to work on what's important, we really need to understand this and let ourselves be creative and give ourselves the situation and the environment where we can think big. So thank you very much, Catherine.
Welcome.
Very stimulating.
Thanks.